I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the damage done by drunk driving and ways to combat it. We're going to discuss what it will take to make our streets, roads, and highways safer and spare us needless tragedies. My guests will be Alicia Turner of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, Beth Rutsky, whose daughter was struck and injured by a drunk driver, and Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Sergeant Mike Duke with the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI, or on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
Support is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu. And by Apparatus, supporting Big Brothers Big Sisters of Central Indiana during National Mentoring Month in January. More on how to become a Big Brother Big Sister or be a part of a big couple at bebigforkids.org.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about drunk driving. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or locate us on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guests with me here in the studio are Beth Rutsky, whose daughter was struck and injured by a drunk driver. Beth, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. It's nice to be here.
It's good to have you here. And also in the studio with me is Mike Duke, who is an IMPD sergeant with the DWI Investigations Unit. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone is Alicia Turner, who is with Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Alicia, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Certainly. It's good to... good to have you as well. Well, I'm going to start, so that we can get a face. Normally, I start these kind the show, as regular listeners will realize, by going broad and then narrowing down. I think I'm going to kind of reverse that here so that we get the human element of this. And Beth, I'd like to talk to you a little bit. If you could share your daughter's story here, what happened, and talk a little bit about what it's done to her life and also your family's life.
Well, John, it is the proverbial parent's nightmare to go to sleep and have the phone ring and have the hospital calling to tell you your daughter's been in an accident and they're getting ready to do some x-rays on her skull. This happened in October of 2005. We had done just that, gone to bed on a Saturday night, and within an hour or two got the call from Wishard's chaplain, which was a little unnerving.
It's scary in and of itself.
Very much so. And so my husband and my son was home on fall break from Wabash, so he happened to be in the house, which was a good thing. And we got to Wishard Hospital, now renamed Eskenazi, is that correct?
Eskenazi, yes.
And
just had the CEO on the show here a little while ago.
And we made our way back to emergency, and we saw my daughter's girlfriend, Emily, in one of the ER rooms, and it was horrific what we saw there, and embraced ourselves for the same when we got into Tiffany's room. And we walked in, it was very dark, she had a collar on, and she was laying in a very sedate way. You could see nothing visible wrong with her.
How old, if I could back up just as a storytelling thing so people can understand, where was the accident, and how old was your daughter at the time?
My daughter was 2005, almost 20. She was 19. She was a sophomore, at IUPUI. And the accident happened near 46 and High School Road, shortly before or after midnight in October 2005. And she didn't look like she was hurt. There was auto safety glass all over the place that had come out of her hair. And she had suffered horrific interior injuries. She had multiple skull fractures, bleeding on the brain, all 12 ribs fractured, her spine damaged when all the muscles started to pull away. She had bruising and contusions, but nothing that was as horrific as her girlfriend, who was very visibly injured. And what had happened was the girls were on their way to a friend's house and had come to a four-way stop and stopped. And as they were accelerating north on High School Road, a drunk driver hit them from behind. And he obviously had not stopped and went directly through the four-way stop and hit them like a pinball coming out of a launching on a pinball machine, and just shot them across three lanes of traffic where they eventually came to a stop. They didn't hit anything, thank goodness. It was a horrific accident. The young man who hit them was the same age as they were. He was already on a drunk driving. He had already been arrested for drunk driving once before. And his BAC was 0.22. So
probably, yeah. Mike Duke, you ought to explain what BAC means here.
in this particular instance, it would be blood alcohol concentration, the amount of alcohol that's in the system, keeping in mind that the person that did this very likely was transported to Wishart Hospital as well, and blood was probably taken from him. As you can imagine, the delay in getting a search warrant, given especially this situation where the person was from Mexico, there's a very strong likelihood that a search warrant was necessary because of the language barrier or whatever. So there's probably an hour or two delay before we're able to get the blood. So 0.22 BAC that long after a crash is obviously going to be well above that, 0.25.
And to give us a context, what is the legal limit?
0.08.
So we're talking almost three times
the
legal limit. So we're talking about someone who was not just mildly intoxicated, but really seriously intoxicated. And I didn't mean to interrupt your story, Beth, but I wanted to put that so people have the details. Okay, please.
Well, and she had a tough go of it. They were taking her for several tests, checking for broken this and broken that. And it's probably fortunate now, I look back on it, she doesn't remember a lot of that. She was in the hospital for several days, and we brought her home. And she still, of course, does not remember most of that. And the impact on her has obviously had a physical impact. She's restricted as to how much physical activity she can do, and so that kind of limits some of her work opportunities. She does have some moments where I think that her putting words together or some of her memories are there's little breaks here and there, and but I think she's compensated for it pretty well. She had to drop out of school that semester, and with some prodding, she went back the following semester. And it took her a little longer to graduate because she couldn't carry the same workload as she had been carrying. And so she did eventually graduate. We're very proud of her for that. And she started a new job actually this week. So we're very excited for her.
Oh, what does she do for a living?
Well, I'd be giving a plug, but she'll be training for advertising sales for Angie's List here in town.
Angie's List.
So. We're excited for her opportunity, so that's why she's not here, and I am.
We are talking about drunk driving here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Alicia, obviously, stories like Beth's and her daughter's are horrific, but you know, given the scope of this, the fact that we have an entire organization, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, they're relatively commonplace, too commonplace. How big a problem is this?
It's a major problem. I hear stories like Beth's every day. That's typically, you know, what my day consists of, is just, you know, listening to victim stories and helping them through the healing and the grieving process. So it is, it's very common, and it's a really big deal in our city, in our state as well.
What are the numbers, you know, the scope of how many, you know, drunk driving I'm not going to ask you to quantify how many people drive drunk, because that's probably, at some level, that gets to the point where you've got to prove a negative. If they don't get caught, you probably don't have a statistical base. But in terms of the drunk driving accidents, drunk driving arrests, how big a problem is it nationally? How big a problem is it here in Indiana?
Well, on a national average, it's typically we see about 325,000 people that are injured in drunk driving crashes each year. And I know listening to Beth speaking before, you know, they refer it to as an accident. And Matt actually refers it to a crash, just because the person that was under the influence of drugs or alcohol, they didn't make a choice to do that. It's 100% preventable. And so, therefore, it's not really an accident. So we do look at it as a crash, because it could have been avoided. But as far as our state, we've been on an incline. So we are constantly increasing our numbers here in Indiana.
Are we ahead or behind the national average?
We're right about there. Between 2008 and 2012, our percentage of drunk driving crashes increased about 11%. So right now we're about, in 2012, we reached, we're under for the national, but we reached about almost 5,000.
Okay. And as you say, the numbers seem to be climbing here.
Yes, absolutely.
So the problem seems to be getting somewhat worse. Obviously, Mike Duke, it's a problem here in Indianapolis. Otherwise, we wouldn't have an entire police unit, with budgets being the way they are,
right,
devoted to DWIs. I mean, how many are we talking about? How many drunk driving arrests are there investigations during the course of a year?
The Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, generally speaking, over the last few years, we've averaged about 2,000 DUI arrests a year. And as you say, given scarce resources within government to do to look in any one particular area, you know, we're doing the best we can. If we had all the resources, and I'm sure every supervisor on the department could come in and make a case for why he needs more, but I believe that we could probably double our arrests without a lot of trouble with more resources. But we just don't have them. We just don't have the resources. We rely a great deal on the general public calling us to tell us that there's an impaired driver. But because obviously eyes and ears out in the public see things where we might not be. And I would say a good percentage of our cases come from crashes, like we've been discussing. The folks at Eskenazi Hospital, you know, I'm on a first-name basis with a lot of people there. I spend a lot of time in those shock rooms. And every word that was just described is something we see on a regular basis, and it doesn't get any easier. Probably the largest percentage, though, comes from officers handing off someone because they have either – we've gotten a report of someone asleep at the wheel at an intersection or off the side of the road, crashed, single vehicle crashes, that sort of thing, where there's no one injured, but they obviously dodged a bullet. If we had more people out there, it'd be easier for us to do it. But obviously, finding them ourselves, the unit is in unmarked cars, and we try to be as stealthy as possible and look for drivers, just following them around and seeing them weaving on the road.
What kind of training do you have to go through to investigate drunk driving?
The NHTSA, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, has developed a training course that officers have to go through when they come through the academy on detection of impaired drivers. And there are any traffic violation that you just commonly see is also something that we look at as an indication of impairment. Aggressive driving, where someone is following too closely and going too fast, that doesn't obviously mean that someone's impaired when they're doing that, but
could just mean they're a bad driver.
Additionally, with the introduction of the cell phones in the cars, that's made our jobs a lot more difficult. When you see someone weaving all over the road and then you pull them over and they They don't have anything.
Got the phone glued to the air.
Right, or they're texting, which is now illegal in Indiana. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it makes it tougher, that's for sure.
And in terms of the 2,000 arrests, what are the penalties associated with getting caught for drunk driving? I want to set us up for the next segment here. So if you could just lay it out, then
sure.
We'll talk about whether those are appropriate or not.
For a first-time offender.
I'll tell you what. Hold that mic, and we'll catch it on the other side.
Sure.
We are talking about drunk driving here on No Limits. My guests are Alicia Turner, Beth Rutsky, and Sergeant Mike Duke. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about drunk driving today on No Limits. My guests are Alicia Turner with MAD, Beth Rutsky, whose daughter was struck and injured by a drunk driver, and Mike Duke, an Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department sergeant with the DWI Investigations Unit. And Mike, just before we went to the break, I was asking you to talk about what the penalties were for getting caught if you were driving drunk.
Generally speaking, it's been my experience in court in Marion County that a first-time offender who is found guilty of OWI will usually get probation, mm-hmm. and they have to go through they have to jump through the hoops that the court puts them through, having to go to a destructive decisions panel and that sort of thing. They're on probation for a period of time, and the Bureau of Motor Vehicles will suspend their license for 90 days. That's generally walking in the door doing it the first time. And again, based on my experience, you know, there are a lot of folks who are in that window right there. Mm-hmm. That describes their experience, and God bless them, because if they do it once and then they look in the mirror and they plan ahead and mm-hmm. don't make the same mistake again, they never see the system again, and then hopefully that's the end of it. If you come back a second time within 5 years and you're convicted, then it's a felony.
Mm-hmm.
Not small potatoes, obviously, having a felony record. It's a D-felony for having a prior within the last 5 years.
And what are the consequences in that case? What can you be sentenced to?
Well, a minimum jail sentence for a felony is 1 year. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, the court takes into consideration the person's, you know, the totality of the circumstances, and they may give them another suspended sentence on some level. It's entirely up to the judge. But you're talking about a felony, which is, as I say, at least a year in jail.
And Alicia, are those penalties appropriate in your view?
In my opinion, I think it could be better. I know a lot of times we're dealing with, when we talk about first offenders, it tends to be the first time that they actually got caught.
Mm-hmm.
I do a victims impact panel where I do get a lot of those offenders who are sentenced and have to go through probation and have to come and sit at my panel, which I bring victims in to speak. And I ask the question at all my panels, you know, how many, this is your first time, your fifth time, and so forth. And a lot of times what I'm finding is that the people who are claiming that they were the quote-unquote first offenders have actually been drinking and driving or under the influence of drugs and driving several times, 10 to 20 times prior to being caught. And so when we look at things like probation and a suspended license, those tend to work to a certain extent. And again, with just looking at our numbers in Indiana and watching how they are continually rising, a lot of these offenders, quote-unquote first offenders, and then these offenders that are driving on suspended license, they're continuing to drink and drive, ignoring the consequences. And so one of the big things that MAD's been pushing for is ignition interlock devices in the vehicles, and I think that would be a better outcome.
Could you explain what that is, just so I know within that world, I know what it is, but the audience, there may be some people in the audience.
Absolutely. So the ignition interlock devices are devices that would be installed in the vehicles of all offenders, including the quote-unquote first offenders. And what it does is when the a vendor is attempting to drive the vehicle, they would first have to blow into the device in order to get it to start. So in having to do that, even if their license is suspended, if this device is on their vehicle, it will prohibit them from driving if they're under the influence of alcohol. Another good thing with the ignition interlock is I know some people have questions as to what if someone else blows into the device for them and then gets the car started, which is a possibility. But with the device, what it does is once the vehicle has been started, when they're en route to their location, it at any time will prompt them to have to blow in it, the device again. So it will give them a couple of minutes to pull the vehicle over and then have to blow into the device again. And so I think that that would be a better solution at this time because, again, what we're seeing is a lot of repeat offenders are continuing to drive on a suspended license, and, again, they're driving drunk. I get a lot of calls about child endangerment where we have a lot of repeat offenders, first-time offenders that are driving with children in the vehicles, which is a huge problem for us here in Indiana. And that would also combat that issue as well.
And I want to ask, Beth, since we talked about your daughters, I'm not going to use the word accident anymore, crash or wreck. And I should say to our listeners, if you want to see what happened in that wreck, we've posted a photo of it on our Facebook page. You just have to go to No Limits WFYI and you can see that. In this case, with that offender, what was the outcome? I mean, it sounds like he did obviously severe damage to your daughter's life and health and damage to others. What was the legal outcome there?
Well, we did get our day in court, which was somewhat satisfying. It's also a little bit satisfying when the person that you have to have a grievance against hears the story in English and in Spanish, so they're hearing you twice. So that was good because he was Spanish speaking. He got the maximum that he could get for this. I think it was two Class D felonies. Because there were two victims in the vehicle. And I don't recall exactly the total amount of time that involves, but, of course, there's time served cuts the time that you actually have to spend there, and then he was deported. So hopefully that's one less driver on our roads here, but there's just another one to take their place who just hasn't been caught yet, and that's always our concern every time any one of us gets in the car and gets out on the road because it's 24/7. This doesn't only happen at between 8 and midnight. It happens all day long, every day, and it's a huge concern. And so, you know, I agree with Alicia. It'd be nice if there were a little more teeth in the penalties. And I don't know how one of the devices that she was talking about would work in this case because this person didn't own a car. He was constantly using other people's cars. So we got our full sentence and it was fully served, and so there's some satisfaction there. Now, on the other hand, there was also huge expenses involved with this that he was uninsured, and so that had to come from somewhere.
And it meant it came from your insurance and from...
From ours and from my daughter's friend, who was the operator of the vehicle that they were in.
We are talking about drunk driving here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can locate us on Twitter at WFYI. Sheila, welcome to the program.
I was thinking that it would be good if our community and nation, whatever, has more information on alcoholism itself. Because when people do these things, a lot of times they're in a blackout, which is one of the final stages of alcoholism. And since it is a disease, and since many people are affected by it, if we could get some help in that area.
Thanks very much for the call and question, Sheila. I'll throw that one to you. Alicia, is that part of it, in addition to the, to increasing the legal penalties for doing this, do we need to provide more treatment options and educate people better?
So. Yeah, I believe so. And not only just the treatment options. But as far as educating, I think that, you know, I say all the time, I think that it's just that it has to do a lot with the media. I think that it's glamorized alcohol and drinking, and people don't really look at the true consequences of things that happen that come with drinking and driving or being under the influence of drugs and driving. And so that's something that I try very hard to get across when I do the panels. They get a lot of, they get graphic at times, but I think people need to see it just because they don't really focus on the reality of what can happen in those situations. So just making people more aware, I think that's really needed.
Mike, I would imagine that's got to be a very difficult part of your job. I mean, you're having to deal with intoxicated people all the time. What sort of, you know, I want you to walk me through that process a little bit about when you okay. when you have to investigate an accident. What things are you thinking? What are you worried about first?
The first thing I'm worried about is anything that's going to happen in court. Mm-hmm. That's where you start every investigation. Where is it going to end? And then you work your way backward to where you're sitting right now. How is what I'm doing right now going to be interpreted mm-hmm. in court? And so the very first thing we do on any case is advise people of their rights and mm-hmm. let them know this is a criminal investigation. And we're going – NHTSA has done a wonderful job, and it started in 1975 with the standardized field sobriety tests, which mm-hmm. were developed back then in the Southern California Research Institute. All the tests that officers are trained to do in this country since 19 – well, we started here in 1993. All of the tests are standardized. And you must do them exactly as they are instructed to you. And so they've really given us a good template to work from. From that point, though, if you have someone who's maybe injured themselves, obviously you're just trying to gather as much evidence as possible. One of the things that we've really worked a lot on in the last few years is getting digital recording of the suspect at the time. It's one thing to say, wow, this guy was really drunk. It's another thing entirely to just push play and let a jury look at just how drunk he was.
So you're talking about digital video recording,
Absolutely.
Not just audio recording.
Correct. Any and all methods that we can portray for a jury to put it in front of a jury and let them get a firsthand look at just how the person was. Alicia had mentioned drugs. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a huge problem for us. You know, there's still the standard issue beer drinker, you know, and that's all they do. But between people who just flat out are addicted to drugs, prescription drugs or, mm-hmm. or illegal drugs, I'm absolutely blown away. You know, I started on with the unit in 2009, and I knew it was a huge problem. But not until, you know, I arrested the first person who had just mm-hmm. shot up heroin mm-hmm. and immediately drove afterward. Mm-hmm. I think I've got probably four or five heroin arrests now. Mm-hmm. And just the idea that you would think heroin's a good idea to inject in my body, mm-hmm. that's enough to blow you away in the first place. But the idea that you would now get in a car mm-hmm. and subject the rest of us to your mm-hmm. your altered state of consciousness. What I like to say is that center line is just a suggestion. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not tall enough to keep anybody from going across it and hitting you head on. Mm-hmm. And if you're driving at night, especially, even mm-hmm. though there's drunk drivers during the day, if you're driving at night, mm-hmm. I just highly recommend that you don't go through an intersection unless you clear the intersection. Mm-hmm. It's not a safe world to just drive down the road and look and, hey, I've got a green light. Everything's fine. And this might be the fact that I'm getting a little bit older anyway and the mm-hmm. fact that my daughter is 17 and a new, mm-hmm. fairly new driver yeah. herself. But I have really slowed down, and I will not drive at night at a speed in which I can't clear an intersection, look down both ways, even if it's a one-way street. This is not paranoia. This is me sitting in the mm-hmm. hospital looking at all these people and seeing that, hey, this guy went the wrong way down New York Street and had a collision, and this is you know, this is the result. Well, guess what? Next time I go down New York Street, guess what's on my mind?
What do you do? You make reference, and presumably – you're talking to people who are in Beth's situation or you know, where you're talking about family members, somebody who's, you know, they're worrying about whether a child or a spouse or a sibling or whomever is going to live and be all right. How do you deal with that? I mean, how do you approach those people? And What kind of training?
Well, I had a little bit of a head start on that. I was in the sex crimes division or sex crimes section of the department for 10 years. I worked in child abuse for a long time.
Oh, boy.
So I think the best way to get that experience, or I should say the best way to handle that is by getting the experience and meeting people whose lives have been just completely turned upside down at one phone call. I guarantee that when we first started talking about this, the very first thing you said was,
she started with the phone call.
Yeah, I guarantee you know what time of night that was, you know?
Yeah.
And right now my daughter's going to be driving home from high school in a little bit, and every time, literally, and she'll tell you, every time she gets in, she's leaving to go get in her truck to leave, I say the number 89, because 89% of drivers have crashes the first 3 years of getting their driver's license, you know, and I stop her and I go, it's not just a number. I want you to think, you know, 89%, that's on top. Mm-hmm. That's if everybody is not impaired.
Mm-hmm.
You mix in the general public and yeah, I mean, this gray hair I have is probably got a lot to do with the job I've been doing for the last 4 years. It's scary out there.
Well, and this is going to be a difficult question for you, so I'll warn you, but there have been a fair number, obviously, of incidents where police officers have been caught now driving right under the influence. What special pressures does that put you and your fellow officers under?
I've arrested three police officers from the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, and they were the saddest investigations that I had because I was watching someone that I thought I could trust, and I found out I couldn't. And a lot of role aides, mm-hmm. a lot of second guessing from other people. Sad, terrible. I don't think I can accurately. I mean, I don't think words can explain the feelings that I had when I had to do that. And I can tell you, I mean, it's a matter of public record. One of them was highly intoxicated,
mm-hmm.
and he was in his personal vehicle. And it was just horrific. Just I couldn't believe I was watching it happen in front of me. The first one was just a kid, a rookie, and he made a big mistake. His BAC was very low,
mm-hmm.
relative to the, you know, it was still above legal limit when he was driving. But just operating a vehicle with alcohol in your system, operating a police car with alcohol in your system, you're fired. That's
mm-hmm.
that. We're done with that.
Mm-hmm.
And we have special investigations. Who's in charge of those investigations when an officer's involved? The prosecutor's office has an absolutely zero tolerance policy for these types of things. The general public obviously does not have any patience for it,
mm-hmm.
and neither do I. And I've made it abundantly clear to any officer who asked me the question, and he'll tell you that I told Chief Height
mm-hmm.
I would be more than happy to arrest him if I found him in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
I told the mayor's chief of staff the same thing. I don't pull any
presumably punches. That you're not arguing that they have a problem.
Not at all. Not at all.
Yeah.
Not
anyway. I was going to throw that lifeline out there. Therefore, you, Beth, you wanted to jump
well,
in.
Well, I think it just points to the fact that this is a problem that happens across every spectrum of our society. It's not just the alcoholic. It's not just the kid who hasn't learned how to stop after a social beer at a football game. And it's not any one particular group or age or segment of society. It's prevalent everywhere. And I think a lot of it goes back to what Alicia said about educating from a young age on what the effects of a certain number of I remember the lessons where a shot is the same as a beer, is the same as a glass of wine. It's the same amount of alcohol. And some people think, oh, I can drink twice as many beers, and they're light beers, you know. And so they're just misinformed. And I mm-hmm. think that continuing education of our young people will certainly help, and it's something I'd strongly be in favor of.
We are talking about drunk driving here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Again, we're talking about drunk driving. My guests are Alicia Turner of MAD, Beth Rutsky, mother of a drunk driving victim, and Mike Duke with the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about drunk driving today on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or on Twitter at WFYI, or if you would like to send us an email, as this listener has done, you can do so by sending it to nolimits@wfyi.org. The listener asks that we not use her name, so I'm not going to do that. But she says, I live with a recovering alcoholic who has lapsed over the years, including in recent weeks. What can I do if my loved one leaves the home in a car and when it's too late to take away the keys or stop the person? And can Officer Duke explain the legal ramifications for loved ones of the drunk driver in case there is an accident or worse, a fatality? Mike?
Well, the best thing that can happen to someone who is driving impaired is to get arrested by me.
Mm-hmm.
Because and this is something that has happened in one instance when I allowed someone a phone call. They called and were trying to elicit a favor to get out of this. And I said, look, I've been reputed to be a guy who would arrest his own mother. Okay, well, I won't, but I will call one of the officers who works for me to arrest my mother. That would not be a problem for me at all.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be more than happy to sit along the side and watch it happen and then go bail her out of jail after she does the time in there that everybody else does. Being arrested for drunk driving is not the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what it is a wake-up call.
Death is the end of the world.
That's right,
yeah.
And it's a conversation that I have with everybody who's not involved in a crash that I arrest when they're feeling really sad for themselves, you know. And I say, look, this is going to be the worst night of your life. You're going into the arrestee processing center. You're going to be in a place you never thought you'd be, and I understand that. And there's no way I can put lipstick on this pig, but I can tell you this. If you had crossed the center line, hit someone head on, and killed somebody, everything would be different for the rest of your life.
There's no coming back from that.
Do you want to be that guy on the front page of the paper? Do you want to be the lead on every story tomorrow in the paper and on TV? You don't want that. So I would say the best thing for someone out there who's got someone in this position is to do the hard thing, because it really is the best thing for them. And if someone were to leave your house and you know they're drunk, call us.
Mm-hmm.
Call us. And we will have hopefully we'll have an officer in the area who can then, and when someone calls in, if they're not willing to testify in court, we cannot just pull that person over. You can't say there's a guy who just left this house and he's driving a yellow pickup truck and his license plate is 12345 and he went southbound on Tibbs. We can't just go pull that person over on that information. We have to independently confirm that that person is driving erratically or have some reason to think they're impaired.
Now, I'm going to take it a little further, but based on what you're just telling me, if you notice when you're out driving around, let's take the family implication out of this, and you see someone driving erratically in a way that suggests that the person's incapacitated in some fashion, you know, can you call and say, you know, I think there may be a problem here, and you ought to get somebody to take a look at it, because I can't, in that case, I can't testify because I don't know. I haven't seen the person.
Yes.
Okay.
And they should definitely call 911, and they should get the license plate number of the car and stay a safe distance from it. Do not pull up next to the person and say, hey, I've called the police. You need to pull up. Don't do anything like that. Don't approach anybody. Don't approach anybody.
Yeah.
Having said that, if you see someone who you believe to be intoxicated, let's say you pull up at the gas station, you see somebody who's gassing up, you should definitely call us. But at the same time, if you have the ability to keep that person from getting in their car, you know, for the general public's safety immediately, they should not be allowed to get in the car. If you've got them living in your home with you, you should do everything you can to keep them from driving as well, obviously.
We are talking about drunk driving here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Farrah, welcome to the program. Farrah?
Oh, hi.
Hi. What's on
Sorry
your mind?
About that.
What's on your mind?
Well, I understand that for the implied consent law that you don't have a right to an attorney whenever you're asked to provide that chemical test. but I'm wondering what training the police have regarding the right to counsel and the implied consent law, and how Miranda, the reading of the Miranda rights, kind of play into that.
Thanks very much. Are you by chance either a lawyer or a law student, Farah?
Yes.
I thought so. Thanks very much. There was a level of detail there in the question. Thanks very much for the call.
Thanks.
Mike.
The Indiana implied consent law states, I have probable cause to believe that you have operated the vehicle while intoxicated. I must now offer you the opportunity to submit to a chemical test and inform you that your refusal to submit to a chemical test will result in the suspension of your driving privileges for 1 year. If you have at least one previous conviction for operating while intoxicated, your refusal to submit to a chemical test will result in the suspension of your driving privileges for 2 years. Will you now take a chemical test? And as
the way you reel that off, I think you've said that a time or two before.
Right. As the two of you can tell, I didn't read that off of a card.
No.
However, in every investigation, I do read that off of a card. I do not do it from memory. I read it from a card so that I do not make any mistakes when I explain Indiana's implied consent law. There are attorneys who will argue that that law means that when you get a driver's license, you are implying that you will submit to a test when an officer has probable cause to make an arrest on you. Others will say, because clearly in your situation, Beth, with your daughter, he didn't have an Indiana driver's license. Mm-hmm. Well, clearly, anybody driving in Indiana, that is the accepted, I believe to be the accepted standard at this point. If you're driving, you have implied that you will give a test or your license privileges will be suspended. When it comes to Miranda, if someone is not allowed to leave, if I'm talking to someone and they're not allowed to leave, and this is a very important word, and I want to ask them questions, then I have to explain their rights to them. I have to give them their Miranda warning. Only then can I use their statements against them in court. Mm-hmm. Now, if I just don't Mirandize, but I also don't ask any questions, but the person is making statements without me prodding them, I can use all of that in court as well. So alcohol is a wonderful lubricant for the voice box, and people don't mind talking. People who are impaired love to talk. And so what we do is we turn off our radios and we let them tell us what happened, even without questions. And that's how we use Miranda. We want to get it up front, but if we don't, if someone's already talking, we don't bother with it.
We are talking about drunk driving here on No Limits. Ellen, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, Ellen. What's on your mind?
Oh, I just wanted to say that some of these accidents have long-lasting effects. My grandmother was killed on November the 5th in 1941 by a drunk driver. And over the years, people would walk up to me and tell me what a wonderful lady she was. You know, great cook, a prankster. And yet, you know, I have no memory of her. And I still harbor a resentment to the man who was driving intoxicated because he stole from me a lifetime of happy memories.
I'm sorry.
So that's all I have to say.
I'm sorry for your loss, Ellen. Well, Beth, I think you can speak to that. I mean, is it possible to get past that kind of moment, or is it?
Well, you know, in these cases, that drunk driver, as Alicia said earlier, clearly made a choice, and everybody has that choice, and the consequences are far-reaching, as the caller just said. We are really blessed that we still have our daughter. The prosecutor who received the photos from the crime scene received them because he generally prosecutes accidents where there are no living victims. And he was quite surprised to find out that two people did survive this crash that my daughter was in. So we realize how blessed we are and how lucky, how fortunate we are, and they had very good care. But a single choice, the wrong choice, just has incredible ripple effect across families and communities, and it's just something that I don't think we can work too hard to eradicate.
Yeah, Mike.
I wanted to chime in with this, and it's something that's I was in the prosecutor's office yesterday, and one of the new Super Bowl ads came out, and somebody was talking about the Budweiser Clydesdales, and they were fawning over the commercial, you know, and it's a great commercial. There's no question. But it's something where it's been glamorized so much that now there's going to be a commercial at the Super Bowl that's going to warm everyone's heart by a company that makes a beverage that impairs you. And mm-hmm. if you drive, you're going to hurt somebody. They're not going to show you. I doubt seriously you even see any beer in the commercial. You'll see the Clydesdales and you'll see the puppy, but you're not going to see the negative side of it. And Indiana, for instance, the first BAC law, the first per se law, the blood alcohol concentration in which you were deemed to be intoxicated to the point that you shouldn't be driving was 0.15.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were a 1.4, I guess that's fine. Okay, mm-hmm. now that is a ridiculous amount now. Now, so we've really changed the atmosphere since the caller's grandmother, I believe she said, was killed. And I that's really sad. You know, when you think back about the times when – and there have been crashes, drunk driving crashes since the invention of the automobile.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody gave it much of a thought.
Mm-hmm.
Now I can tell you that Terry Curry – and the prosecutor's office has done a magnificent job.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Hershauer, Denise Robinson, you know, these are people in the prosecutor's office who work with the fact team and prosecute people to the fullest extent of the law. Our investigations are as aggressive as any homicide.
Mm-hmm.
We will go to no end. There's no end I won't go to try to get evidence. We go to convenience stores and get their surveillance video. I've gone to people's homes and arrested them out of their own shower. I mean, there is nowhere I won't go to make a DUI arrest.
Mm-hmm.
When my unit, we are, as you can tell, very passionate about this, and we treat everybody exactly the same, exactly the same. We're going to treat you very nicely. We're going to be very polite to you, but make no mistake, we're here to investigate whether or not you're impaired above the legal limit or to the point that you're in danger to the public, and we're going to arrest you.
Alicia, I want to throw a question to you that we've gotten from a listener who didn't want to go on the air. Are there fewer arrests, drunk driving arrests, in cities that have good public transportation systems?
Honestly, I don't know. I don't have the research on that. I know that...
Provocative question, though.
Yeah, but I know that it is a bit underutilized, you know, as far as Indianapolis, for instance. I mean, we have public transportation. We even have smaller companies that offer free rides. I know there's cars that drive around Broad Ripple. They have, like, the mustache symbol on the front of their vehicles. I mean, there's a lot of options, but people don't utilize those things. And so another big thing that, you know, we should be educating and pushing is to plan ahead, because people don't think about those things until after they're out and in the bar and then they have to get home. So
we are talking about drunk driving here on No Limits. Pete, welcome to the program.
Hello. You have an excellent program today, as
Thank
always.
You. Thank you. What's on your
Can
mind?
I compliment the very dear relative of mine, long since passed, realized that I was drinking too much. And we're talking 40 years ago. I'm much, much older now and wiser. And she totally advocated with me total abstinence of alcohol. And in 35 years, I have not had a drink. Her point was that anyone who drinks any alcoholic beverage, something is troubling them. So not to sound at the risk of bad-mouthing the beer companies, the whiskey distillers, et cetera, which I know is a huge mammoth industry. What about personal responsibility of people just saying, hey, I'm not going to drink anything. I'm more than being the designated driver at the party. I'm not going to drink anymore at all, and I'm just going to take these chips off the table and take all the risk factor off the table. And I'll just take your question off air your answer off air.
Thanks very much, Pete. I'm going to throw that one to you, Beth, I think.
Boy, that's a tough one. because I enjoy a glass of wine. I don't find that that's a big issue, but I don't get in my car after I've had a glass of wine. That's just something, not behind the wheel anyway. I think that some of our kids have gotten pretty wise about this. I hear more... and I say kids, people that are my daughter's age now in their mid-20s to early 30s, I hear more of them talk about that, you know, so-and-so has already said they'll be our designated driver, or we're taking a cab, or I hear them talk about that more than when I was growing up. And I certainly experienced deaths of students I went to school with that were mm-hmm. alcohol-related deaths. And so I just think that, you know, that's a personal choice. I don't think you can legislate or command people not to drink. But I think that people need to make responsible choices. Now, some people don't have the ability to make those kind of choices, either due to immaturity or not enough education, or they've grown up in a household where that is just part of everyday life is overindulging. So, you know, those are bigger social issues. But in terms of making that choice to drink alcohol and get behind the wheel of a car, that's a personal choice.
We've got just like a minute left here. So what I'm going to ask real quickly of each of you, and I'm going to start with Alicia. Could you give me in like 15, 20 seconds one practical thing we could do to improve this situation, to address this problem? Alicia?
One practical thing I would say, again, to plan ahead and have that designated driver. But, I mean, we have the House bill right now, 1344, for that ignition interlock, and I strongly believe that that would help with our increasing numbers here in Indiana.
And I'll throw it to Beth next. Let Mike have the last word.
I think parents have to talk to their kids seriously. They have to have some teeth behind any punishments if their children are drinking, number one, underage, but getting behind the wheel. And just educate them on the effects of alcohol on the body. And I think that that's a good start.
Okay. Mike?
I would say when you were just discussing just a moment ago about families, I've arrested three generations of a family. So I can't recommend strongly enough that education take place and that someone take some responsibility in the home and put an end to that type of behavior. But I say the one practical thing, I would agree with you guys that planning ahead will keep you from meeting me. So if you can envision being in my back seat, spending thousands and thousands of dollars on your defense and sitting for the night in the worst place you can possibly imagine, you know,
suddenly makes calling a cab seem like a much better idea.
I believe
sure
it is.
Does.
Well, I think that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank each of you. Alicia, thank you very much for joining us.
Anytime.
Beth, thank you for joining us and for sharing your story. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sergeant Mike Duke, thank you for joining us. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits on 90.1 is made possible by your membership and by Apparatus, supporting Big Brothers Big Sisters of Central Indiana. Over 600 children in Central Indiana are waiting for a positive role model to help them believe in their dreams and achieve success. More at BeBigForKids.org. And by the International School of Indiana's Open House for age 3 through grade 3 on Thursday, February 6th from 8:30 to 11:30 a.m. and 4 to 6 p.m. with information on language immersion and international baccalaureate education. More at ISIND.org. This is WFYI 90.1 FM and HD1 Indianapolis. And from the campuses of Franklin and Wabash Colleges, WFCI 89.5 FM Franklin and WNDY 91.3 FM in Crawfordsville. You can find this edition of No Limits along with our archive at WFYI.org/No Limits.
You're tuned to WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.